Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Raven Cast. The Raven Cast is a product of the Raven Foundation, where we use mimetic theory to make religion reasonable, violence unthinkable, and peace a possibility. And in this episode, we're going to be talking with the Dr. Jason Okrzynski about the saints, and particularly why Protestants need to reclaim the saints in our lives. Jason is one of the pastors at the First Congregational Church of Wilmette in Wilmette, Illinois. A fantastic church. So if you are ever in the northern suburbs of Chicago, go check out the First Congregational Church of Wilmette. Jason earned his MDiv from Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, and recently graduated from Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary with a PhD in Christian Education and Congregational Studies. I'm excited to talk with Jason today about the saints, because mimetic theory claims that we are formed in relationship with our models, and reclaiming the saints as models in our lives could lead the world into a more peaceful future. Jason has recently written and delivered a paper for the Religious Educators Association called For All the Saints, The Cult of Saints and Theological Imagination in the Art of Liberal Protestant Youth Ministry. So, without further ado, here is Jason Okrzynski. Jason, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Adam. It's a joy.
Well, I cannot wait to talk with you about the saints. I think that the saints are crucially important, especially when it comes to mimetic theory, because mimetic theory basically claims that we are formed by our models. And for better or for worse, this is where we receive our identity from, those who are in our lives. And so it's important to consciously choose good and healthy models, because if we don't, so often models will end up choosing us, and they aren't always the most healthy models. And so I think it's important to reclaim the saints as models for our lives. So I'm just really interested in talking with you about the saints. Let's start off by asking, how did you get interested in the saints?
Well, from the really committed scholarly standpoint that I'm trying to reclaim them now, it really came up in my dissertation, where my dissertation was on, the first section was on Martin Luther's theology. And really, in my reading, Luther's infamous theology of law and gospel, whereby God speaks to human beings in words of law that kill and words of gospel that bring to life, is certainly addressed, but whereas that's often the focus of Luther's theology, I actually understand that as being Luther's pedagogy. His understanding about how people are formed is God speaks to them words of law and gospel. And there's a number of things about that theology that I think it's problematic, in part, that there's a whole bunch of other things that Luther believed. For me, I in particular have a focus that Luther had an entire theology of gift, in which what we today very popularly have often reclaimed, at least in part thanks to Karl Barth, perichoresis, the mutual giving of the Father to the Son, and the Son to the Father, and the Spirit to the Son, and the Father, and so on and so forth. At one point Luther goes so far as to say, this is what it means to be a God, to give good gifts. And so Luther, when Luther looks at the scriptures, when Luther looks at the identities of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, what he sees is this constant gracious giving of God's self to human beings. And Even law and gospel are words of God. Law is a gift. It helps humans live civilly together. Gospel is certainly a gift. But the heart of Luther, at the heart for Luther of Christian theology, is this understanding of God as gift giver. And so the dissertation focuses on what Lutherans often say is a response to God's graciousness, which is vocation. And for Luther, just the call of both law and gospel, in some sense, in vocation, is to be Christ. So Luther understands from his medieval worldview that every human being has three, he calls them stande, stands, locations, and they're primarily, the two primary places are one's family, which for Luther is the place where the kingdom of God and the gift-giving of God can become most prominent. And secondarily, one's work, where one can be Christ by literally doing something useful for the world, caring, being Christ by caring for the world. And so in the midst of all this theology is this irony that it's primarily Luther who throws the saints away. And yet Luther has this constant stress against speculation. He doesn't want Christians speculating. And so the irony does begin to arise exactly along the lines of mimetic theory that certainly we hope that Scripture plays an important role in our ministry. But since Luther, this is why I've now moved to talking about liberal Protestants, we've destroyed the authority of Scriptures. So we still hold them, we still love them. But the simple way that Luther just insists you can read the Bible to each other and God will just form and transform you, I'm not sure it works, I guess, is where the problem comes. And so the question becomes, however God works to speak through us, through Scripture, there's a point where a question arises for me with young people that their imaginations are co-opted. Couple things happened in the last 100, 150 years. We've radically changed the social standing of young people. In 1880, you could pretty well count on a young person to live their adolescent life with all of the neurobiological and social changes they're undergoing, surrounded by adults. Most of them would have spent their days in the family work. And so they had these models. They were cradled throughout adolescence in a model. And in the early 20th century, largely as part of urbanization and industrialization, the family system changes radically. Dad, at that time, it really was predominantly men. Dads went off to a city to get a job, and they left the home to get that job. And the Depression hit. And rapidly we move to a high school system that pulls youth out of the family, out of apprenticeship, and places them in high schools together. And I don't think it's a coincidence that in the 50s and 60s we see this explosion of youth culture, which, you know, we all want to get excited that the Beatles are awesome, but make no mistake, at its heart, it's just a marketing, it's just an intense marketing system.
Yeah.
And youth employment raises during that time as well. And so you have all these pieces coming together to get youth out of the job market and then send them back in as local grocery clerks in order to make them consumers. And so, within that then becomes this need for a non-speculative witness about what is vocation, what is the faithful Christian life. And so therein, I think, the saints arise, and the metaphor that came out of the REA conference, but really has it been a useful metaphor, is this notion of that they stir imagination. And this is a part of the key piece. That it isn't that their example is you need to go be more like Saint Francis, so much as to draw close to someone like Saint Francis who humbly but yet uncompromisingly lived out this life of radical love and service, presents a different picture than the consumer identity that we have so swiftly handed on to our children. And so it's simply a way of these real lives. And part of what becomes interesting is instead of fighting about theoretical theology, you just tell a story of an actual person. This is what St. Francis actually did. So we can do theology. Theology is exciting. I love theology, and I don't mean to disparage scriptures. I love the scriptures, but there's something needful in that mix of let's not speculate about theology. Let's not argue about models. Let's not argue about whether scripture is authoritative. Let me just tell you about St. Perpetua, who's amazing and kind of disturbing. So that's the where the basic interest arose, was this need to offer dynamic, and you know, to some degree the saints are radical, but that also makes their narratives black and white. I mean, there's a clear narrative with St. Francis that he rejects his privilege and goes and cares for the marginalized and is incredibly joyful doing it. It's just filled with joy. And he also, you know, St. Francis, by his very nature, overcomes this anthropocentric theological need we have to put humans at the center of everything, because he sees the sick leper as needful to Christ as the bird or the wolf. And it seems to be part of what rejecting his privilege opens his heart up to receive, a simpler kind of both present yet cosmic gift. You know, and the different saints have different ways they each do this. So
it's just so fascinating to me, because Francis rejects, as you say, he rejects all of this privilege that he has.
Yeah.
I mean, his dad is a wealthy merchant.
Cloth merchant. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he's got all of these great things. He goes to all of these parties and has this great wealth, and he ends up rejecting all of that and moving in a different direction. And in this different direction is where he really experiences, as you say, this great joy.
Yeah.
And as you're talking about our modern consumer culture, I think that Francis is a great saint because he's a great model, because a lot of what consumerism is get more stuff and that's going to make you happy. And Francis sees getting more stuff isn't making him happy. It's actually maybe weighing him down. And where he really experiences joy is in denying that stuff and living in this kind of community that you're talking about in the Trinity of love, of giving and receiving, but especially to those who are probably marginalized. So they're like the dynamics between Francis in the 12th, 13th century and our modern culture are just so profound.
Well, and by the way, I've been desperately trying to find someone to make the accusation and historically support it that his father's wealth is in some way involved in war profiteering, but no one's made that case. So I'm just throwing it out there. I don't think it's probably a thing. But I mentioned that only because you can't make this stuff up sometimes. St. Francis grows up quite drunk on his privilege. And he gets sent off to fight the Turks, the Muslims, in like the first European Islamophobic, the Crusades. He gets sent off, and it's at the Crusades that he ends up coming back and seeing that he has a vision of Christ who says, "Repair my church," to him. And so he connects this protection of privilege with this need to go off and fight the Turks. And by the way, later in life, it's told, and I think it's debated in historians, but there are some respectable historians who are convinced this actually happened, that he went on his own pilgrimage to meet with the Saladin, the son of the Sultan, and came away convinced. I don't know of any writing that testify to this, so that's where the history gets a little dodgy, but that Christians and Muslims should be able to live and care for the world peacefully side by side with their different understandings of who God is. So just an example of this incredibly relevant story. You know, if you can do good history in telling your story, you know, we could argue about whether God intra-Trinitarianly is really divided into three, or is a metaphor, and we can talk with our kids. And we do, I mean, I think this is actually useful. You can talk about metaphor and phenomenology, but there's something about pairing that with, no, this guy did this. Like, this is what we actually know about his real life that I just think is profoundly moving and informative. And as I said, I think stirs imagination in a way that it isn't about trying to sell our youth a religious agenda. There's this thing Sophia Cavalletti once said where she says, people get concerned that I'm trying to religiousize children. And she says, no, in my experience, children are yearning for transcendence and they're yearning for some understanding of their finitude and their limits. And I'm just inviting them into this. And I feel like that's the thing. Youth are yearning for joy, and we all are. We're all yearning for meaning and we're yearning for good lives. And the saints just present a witness to what that might be, an example again. So
yeah, and I just keep getting struck by the saints and this kind of denial of material goods that kind of weigh us down, so that they can live for, as you say, something that's more meaningful. A lot of these things, like fill your lives with consumerism, fill your lives with these certain things, and you know, there's always the next generation of the iPhone that's the best iPhone ever, and you have to get it in order to fulfill your life. And this is not just a message of consumerism, but St. Francis had to go through this, and all of these things just kind of weigh you down and get in the way, distract you of what matters. I'm reminded of another saint, the Buddha, who was all about detaching from material goods. And a lot of people think that Buddhism is just all about detaching, but to me, I think it's much more about detaching from the things that get in the way of what really matters in life. And so you see this throughout many spiritual traditions. And it's as important in today's, as you brought up, consumer culture as it is ever. What do you see as consumer culture getting in the way of when it comes to youth today?
Well, you know, I do like that word attachment. And it's interesting because we as we're learning more and more about neuroplasticity, you can do quite a bit during adolescence to create addictions, whether they're literal addictions such as alcoholism, or it may just be kind of an addiction to needing to stroke your amygdala in a certain way, to seek out certain, you know. There's been research that it's been proven that Taco Bell, for example, has a lab where they just study how can we fire the neurons more efficiently to create stronger cravings. And so, you know, in the Christian tradition, there's been a refusal. Dualism and Gnosticism. There's been a refusal to separate mind and spirit. The soul and the person are one, and a human is a material creature. So. There's something about seeking. So this is where Luther becomes helpful. Luther has some limits because in the 16th century, there was no social mobility. If your great grandfather picked up horse manure in the streets of Wittenberg, guess what you and your children were going to do. But there is this notion to Luther that your job is not about personal fulfillment, but it's about offering yourself to care for earthly need and to be Christ. And so it has been my experience that this is an appealing idea to people, that I would give my gifts to the world to care for it. But, you know, if you need to fit, you know, $20 worth of Taco Bell into a month to make sure that you get your fix or whatever it is. I don't know that people are choosing careers to fit Taco Bell into their lifestyle. But, you know, maybe it's certain trips to Mexico. Maybe it's you need to have certain kind of clothes. I mean, you know, we've been talking about these things for 50 years, and they I think are only getting worse. That if your entire, you know, you spend a lot of your time at whatever your job is. So that whole job is driven to protect and pursue privilege, to get certain amenities that's what your meaning comes out of. Right? to me, that just flattens your humanity itself. I mean, you're the way your habits, your patterns of being, the way that your brain forms or is sustained, all these things will follow. So, for example, the saints are often one of the shorthands for the saints is these were the friends of God. So there you have a positive. What is their attachment? It's their relationship with the divine, the eternal, the transcendent. And so that's a big piece is what are the attachments we're intentionally forming and how do our life narrative. So another piece is identity. And identity can be tricky because we fight over identity. With youth, sometimes Christian identity means, you know, something like trying to make them behave. Generally, it means we're trying to make them go to church more, right? Which I'm all for. That's awesome, I think, when kids go to church. But kids tend to go to church when they're finding meaning and community there. So the thing about identity is it's fluid, it's changing, it's socially constructed, but it's constructed and reconstructed. And on some level, identity is not some box we create to mark off. As you go through life, the memories you collect and the relationships that make up who you are will continue to form your identity. We know that the brain does not store memories like a computer. The memories are stored randomly throughout the whole brain. And every time you recall a memory, you just randomly pull things together and reconstruct it. And so identity tends to just be, this is Dan McAdams from Northwestern, but he says identity is just a story we tell as an answer to the question, who are you? But what we know about memory states that we tell that story a little differently every time we tell it. And so two things I come out of this. One is a direct response, again, to the attachments we form, especially with what we know about neuroplasticity, are more than free will decisions. There are concrete neurobiological realities that make us, that form certain habitual proclivities towards being a certain kind of person. And so the choices we make, especially during adolescence, will have formative effects over the life cycle. And they literally are attachments. And the earlier and the deeper attachments are formed, the harder those habits are to break and transform. But again, this idea of imagination secondarily also comes in, that the saints bear witness to certain sorts of existential proclivities. They both lived out dynamic lives, and a lot of them also told us. St. Francis writes about his spirituality. He tells us what his experiences were. He tells us about his pathos. What did he feel? What did he learn to love? And he tells us about what practices he not in the case of St. Francis, he writes a rule. This is how to form these affections in your life, and this is how to sustain this imagination as a community. Sometimes Lutherans get really nervous about practice language, but Luther himself wrote about liturgical practices as making God known over and over again. So that's a second piece, I think, for me is again, that I keep coming back to this, but there's just this concrete interruption when a saint is brought into the room to telling us a different model of how we might live into our callings, not just the sense of our professional calling, but our existential callings. How are we called to exist while we're existing?
Yeah, and your phrase that you use, that the saints are seen as friends of God.
Yeah.
I love that in part because it matters what this God is that we're friends with. So in many cases, like God is our ultimate model, our ultimate saint, if you will. And so you've put forward a beautiful image of God with perichoresis, this God who gives and receives in the spirit of love. And if we could live into that, the world would be such a better place.
Yeah. Well, and I'm writing this paper right now. It's I didn't anticipate it would come up, but it's been kind of fun that it has, because it's the first time I've been doing some heavy lifting with Luther again since the dissertation. So I had all I could stomach of the man for 4 years, and then now I'm kind of back to him. And it's been fun because I'm less in awe of him at this point. But really, really, you know, I've gotten a couple of Lutherans who've gotten nervous that this is works righteousness. And the thing that occurs to me, a couple things have occurred to me. One is that I need to state is that I think one of the things we celebrate, and Luther's partner in crime, Philip Melanchthon, says this, is that the church has historically given credit to grace itself, that the saints are a gift, that God is part of the agent that produces these remarkable individuals. And so two important things come out of that. One is it releases us from the fear that the point of learning about the saints is to be them. Because if we move, if we have a theology that wants to claim the phenomenological experience that God is an agent in the world and in our lives, it actually can go the opposite way, which is what I think a big part of what Luther was trying to fight about, is that God is predominantly in a social relationship with community. But that doesn't mean that God is not personally formative for each of us. And so when we point to the saints, we do point to them as we remember this story because God produced something unique here. But that doesn't need to downplay that what God is doing with you is something unique as well. It might not be as offensive to the world as a Saint Francis or a Saint Perpetua, which really we remember them, we celebrate them. But the church has to continually learn over and over again to celebrate its saints, because most of the saints freaked out all the Christians in their own day. So the saints are remembered because they were so offensively faithful. And so that's a key piece for me is realizing that they also, it isn't just that they bear witness to the anthropological side of life. This is what a dynamic Christian narrative looks like. They also are bearing witness to what God does in life, that God is present. And so the point being that the saints themselves are a gift from God, of God's grace. And I think youth ministry, that's a powerful thing we can proclaim to youth, again, who are a little bit hardwired towards impulsivity, and who all of whom make some choices that they wish they wouldn't. To be faithful witnesses to, I mean, St. Francis, for all we know about him, was kind of a punk when he was a teenager. He was a womanizer and a drunk. So, you know, he grows out of that by God's grace. And so I think often, here's the irony, when liberal Protestants get embarrassed about the word sin and the doctrine of sin, they also tend to be very worried about saints. Which, again, in my Lutheran tradition, right, Luther was Lutheran, say, well, you're always a saint and a sinner. And there seems to be something, you know, I'm one of the people who's trying to tease out concretely why we lost these important doctrines that make Christianity difficult to make any sense of if you abandon them and get embarrassed of them. But one of the myths that then comes is that the saints are that we should be ashamed we're not all saints, and that the saints encourage untenable religiosity. And I don't want to say that there are none that do not. Some of my favorite saints freak me out still. Julian of Norwich, I adore, and she freaks me out. She sits in this box for like years. It's freaky. It's weird.
Yeah.
But that's part of what's fascinating about it, right? But the point I want to make is this. When you get over your fear of the saints and start studying them, you find out that most of them carried great pain and great sadness and struggled through incredible temptation. And most of them have some skeletons in their closet. And they actually become witnesses not just of holiness and friendship to God, but also of real humanity, of that they are real people. Which, I don't know, maybe that's the scariest thing to find out. That they're not simply, you know, spiritual dynamos, but they just didn't, they left everything on the table. And that's what I think for many of them produced the courage to live out these lives before the world.
Well, it's interesting for you to say that they were offensive even in their day. because they can be offensive now. And one of the stumbling blocks that they could see that you're pointing towards is that we end up comparing our lives to the saints. And when I look at Saint Francis, on one level, I'm just incredibly inspired by what he did. But on another level, I'm like, listen, I've got a family and kids to get through college, and I'm living like I'm trying to get through my life now. There's no way that I can live up to what Saint Francis did. And I can start feeling a sense of shame in my life when I compare myself to the saints. I want to say that that's like, that's not the right mindset to have about the saints. That's a mindset of rivalry with the saints. And that's not what they're here for. They're here to show us that a different world is possible. And when you talk about vocation, I see that. It's not, do I have to deny everything in my life to live like Saint Francis? It's not becoming Saint Francis. It's, can I show a little bit more love and compassion into the world? Can I use these religious practices to lead me in that direction so that a little more and more my life is patterned after the God who is in this endless relationship of love, of giving and receiving, knowing that I'm going to make mistakes, I'm going to mess it up. But at the same time, this God who is endlessly receiving in love and grace is coming to me in the same spirit of love and grace, even when I mess it up, especially when I mess it up.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot I want to respond to there. Let me start by saying this. One of the ironies for me of the resistance in most liberal Protestant congregations to claim the saints. And full disclosure, as a Lutheran, I grew up, I have both the green hymnal and the red hymnal, which represent the last 50, 60 years of Lutheran liturgical practice. And in both of those hymnals, there is a calendar of the saints, which effectively canonizes. That is a canon, whether we call it that or not. Now, here's where the irony comes. Just last week, a report came out, and this is not new. We knew this. We've known this for years. It cost, I think they said, an average of $500,000 for the Vatican to go through an entire process of examination, vetting, voting, and ultimately canonization of a saint. The ELCA just had a committee that, like, voted and picked the calendar of saints.
Nice.
And we also know that there are people when Rome canonizes that do better. And it looks like what liberals would accuse it of looking. White males that start a religious order do quite well in getting canonized. Third world priests often get beatified quite quickly, but they don't get sainted as easily. Especially one of the sticking points is if the regime they were fighting against is still in power, the Pope will often put off canonizing them. Happily married women with children are this won't shock you, almost never sainted by the church. We as liberal Protestants have the liberty. You know, I preached at my grandma's funeral a couple weeks ago, and if there ever was a Lutheran saint, it was Verna Zerke, who I don't think had a day in her life that she wasn't, in a metaphorical sense, washing feet. I mean, literally, this woman raised her own children. She raised my brother and I, her grandchildren, and our cousins as well. She raised her own sister and her own brother to a fair degree. Both of them said she raised me more than our mother. And then she raised all of their children to a fair degree. She also worked at a nursing home. She was a single mother because my grandfather died of liver failure when my mother was 8. And so this woman was just literally washing feet and washing bodies and feeding children and correcting children and nurturing children and cooking food. And she was an expert seamstress. In her spare time, she would make these beautiful quilts, handmade quilts. My wife and I still have used the one that we got for our wedding, and we got them as children. And so as saints, as Protestants, we have the freedom of all saints to say, no, we thought Matilda was a saint also to us. And we don't need to say less of a saint. We can still claim this priesthood of all believers understanding of sainthood. And I guess that's the second thing I want to say. I think that would help us celebrate the gift that God gives us in the saints without needing to kind of make this unhelpful comparison that I somehow need to be Saint Francis. Now I do begin to wonder, this is one of the checks to identity theory. If there is sometimes an overly cautious need to be something or be someone, you know, to have some sort of concrete objective yardstick, whereas, you know, the Christian concept of kenosis that has often been used, there's endless important womanist and feminist writings about the problems of kenosis, because often men in power in the church have told women to be kenotic while they themselves acted out of self-interest. There's not time to explore all that now, but I am struck from the aspect of religious affections. There is something about letting go of needing to be something, needing to create an identity, that, again, I think the saints draw us into the question of who are you, where are you at, what do you have to give, and how do you sustain, you know, the word humility. I've been trying to get to it. There's something about humility, and I'm not saying I'm that good at humility, but I have certainly encountered people who just seem humble, not like ho-hum, woe is me, but rather humble in the sense of being strong, dynamic people that see themselves as part of a human and creaturely community. My grandma probably was one. I mean, she never questioned whether she was there to care for people or not. And there weren't all these crises of who am I? There was just, well, who am I? Well, the question for her wasn't who am I, what do the people around me need? And how can I meet that need? And so I do think there is something about religiosity and transcendence that can certainly create, you know, a manic need to be dynamic, but it can certainly do the opposite to help one become kenotic, not in an abusive sense, but in a almost Buddhist sense. Self, what self? I am part of a creaturely community, and that's what I'm here to do, which is the picture, I think, again, to go back to it, I get from Luther. That's this image I have from Luther, that our jobs are not about defending privilege, but being a part of a creation and a humanly community.
I love it. And Girard says that we are our relationships. Like the self is dependent upon the others. So when your grandma says, when your grandma doesn't go through an identity crisis of who am I, it's who is out there and who needs help and what can I do? It's this very relational way of forming an identity. And I think that maybe in asking about others and where they're at, there's where we begin to find who we are in this kind of relationship with one another. Desmond Tutu has this great African phrase, Ubuntu, which is I am because we are, in this great interrelationship. And this is what the saints have tapped into on a fundamental level. It's this relational way of being in the world where my identity is dependent upon being in relationship with others. Individualism is another, along with consumerism, individualism of the modern world takes us away from that. I am my own person. I think, therefore I am. Those kinds of phrases of the modern world kind of get us away from the relational aspect.
Well, and again, I'm finding myself conversing with Buddhism because there is, although Christianity has also had this conversation about the fact that on some level, the belly is never full. The appetite is infinite. And so what conspicuous consumerism promises us is it's never going to be full, so you better just keep consuming, right? And that can become the habit. And I suspect that that's part of maybe the disease that poisons us when we think, I'm not a good enough dad, I'm not a good enough Christian. That liberal free market modernity sees human beings as agents and as producers. So Advent is starting next Sunday, and there is this notion that I think is the worst theology of Advent. It's the elf on the shelf theology. If you have an elf on the shelf, I apologize.
Yes, we have the elf on the shelf. Yes.
Yeah. So the theology is God is watching. You better be in your best behavior, and you'll get uh-huh. stuff, uh-huh. right?
Yep.
And again, I apologize. I go back to Luther. You'd think I wrote a dissertation on him or something. Luther insists, and I'll be preaching this in some way at First Congregational Church of Wilmette next Sunday. Luther insists that the best way to see Christ is as a gift, not as a covenant, not as try harder, not as the elf on the shelf is watching you, but God gives you God's self. God just gave. God didn't establish rules. There's an annunciation and there's a Baptist who are paving the way, but God just gives this gift. And you can reject the gift. Mm. You can receive it kind of poorly, but God gives the gift. And I think sometimes Protestants want to push back on, you know, even Bonhoeffer's cheap grace. Well, it's not cheap grace. I think there's a point where what that is liberal modernity. We're saying we are agents of history. We are producers. We are responsible. And there's a piece of in Jesus and ironically in the saints who sometimes make us the irony is this. We sometimes think, I think, what makes us nervous at times about the saints is we aren't producing enough. But each of the saints attributes all of it to God that I just received. And so there is something, again, about our Western mindset that we need to produce enough, be good enough, be responsible enough, and be agents of history. And it doesn't know how to just receive the gift of existence. And so I think it's tied first and foremost to just one of the tenets of here I'm gonna turn off half of your listeners of Marxist materialism is that history is not the perfect unending march of human liberty and ideologies, but bellies and bodies and how we get shelter, how we get clothes, how we get food, how they're made, and how we get them always shape our ideologies. And I think, you know, what I said about Christianity taking material seriously, I'm not saying Christians all have to be Marxist at all. That's not my point. My point is that whatever your ideological commitments are to what the market should or shouldn't look like, there's something about the base reality that humans are bodies and that what we ultimately are is a gift that we couldn't earn or create. And, you know, again, the saints become this incredible witness to that. And I think maybe the problem is that there's a hermeneutics of Western free market democracy that wants to read the saints as authors, as exemplars. What did the saints do to claim this identity? And there's something about just being open to receive their witness that can be incredibly liberating. And it's one of those tricks, because what I'm trying to say is, on some level, I'm saying, well, if you'd read about the saints, you'd become more like them, which is not, again, presses on that. But what do I need to do? What do I need to do to produce holiness, to produce righteousness, to produce justice? And I guess what I'm getting at is I think the saints flip the question of what do we have to do to receive holiness, to receive justice, to receive the Spirit, to receive today. St. Teresa, who is being sainted, I believe, next week, there's a story she claimed that every morning before she opened her eyes, and, you know, this is one of the stories that gets better when you know how much she struggled. Before she would open her eyes, she would turn in her heart to God and say yes to today. And it, you know, it sounds like a cheesy self-help thing, except that it might be a very simple and powerful practice if you think of it, again, not as a producer, but as her receiving a gift of another day. And then she went out, and what did she do with that gift? She shared it serving others.
Powerful story. And talk to you. You give a lot in your paper to Saint Perpetua. And I think that she is a saint that we don't hear much about, but is a wonderful saint to know. So can you tell us a little bit about Saint Perpetua?
Yeah, and Saint Perpetua sometimes gets swept in the luck rug because she really, there's some parts of her story that are incredibly unnerving. Perhaps most notably, she's in prison in Carthage, prisoner of the Roman Empire, and she is waiting. She's been told in no uncertain terms that if she doesn't make a sacrifice to Rome, she's going to be thrown into the Colosseum, thrown to the in her case, the story goes that she literally took the gladiator's sword and put it up to her throat. So there's one of the cheery, family-friendly parts of her story. But the piece I find most unnerving is while she's in prison breastfeeding her infant. So again, this modern narrative of productivity and responsibility wants us to go, you can't be a martyr, you have a baby. You have to go grow up and be a producer of motherhood. And the interesting thing, the way that I read her in the paper is, at the end of the day, the powers that be always, as their final threat, have these machines of death, the anxiety that you will cease to be, and the last call or the last line in the sand for any sort of imperial power or whatever is to threaten your own being. And maybe this actually gets intensified for liberal moderns because of this conviction to needing to produce. It's hard to produce anything, we think, if you're dead. And yet, Saint Perpetua, another huge part of her story is her relationship with her father. And for the Roman people, specifically her father, a daughter, even a married daughter, was still ultimately the property of her dad. She's not a person. She was her dad's property. And so a dad could, of course, I mean, this is more familiar to us, marry her to a wealthy family in order to further his business. She was a business tool. But a father could also, the paterfamilias, which is the famous term, could also pull a woman with children out of her family if that helped his business dealings, to spite the family or whatever. And so one of the famous images of Perpetua is her baby at breast staring down her father and saying, I cannot sacrifice to Rome because I only have one God, and it's the God made known in Jesus. And so you have this witness of all the attachments that again, poor old Taco Bell wants to, you know, put the chalupa right in our face. You have this staring down of the dominant narrative that we all so unquestioningly inhabit. And you have Perpetua telling this other story of, even to death, I'm going to follow this sense of goodness. And we have, maybe this supports the narrative too much, but she ends up be producing this dynamic witness of a martyr who stares down the powers of the world and is martyred at a young age and does orphan her children. So again, it's an unnerving story. And I don't mean to paint over and say it's okay that she abandons her infant because she stares down patriarchy. I think maybe the Brady Bunch witness of everything's going to get tied up and be perfect in a half an hour also needs to be deconstructed. That again, our identities are are changing, and we enter certain social situations and we have to make choices. But certainly Perpetua bears witness to a remarkably convicted woman who did stare down the powers of her day, and understood, you know, in a sense of the Stoics. Carthage would have known Stoic philosophy well, and they would have said that better than a great life is a great death, where you are so in control of your life that even under death, you refuse to contradict yourself, to compromise. And so she's a powerful witness, she lends herself to all kinds of contemporary questions about patriarchy and consumerism and feminism and womanism and I think even human rights to some degree, that she may have chosen not to compromise herself, but she did not set up the terms whereby you have to give sacrifice to the Roman gods or be put to death.
I think it's so fascinating, her life, because it is about the Roman gods. And we usually think of this as, you know, when you're not sacrificing for the Roman gods, oh, that's a religious thing. But it's not just a religious thing. It's a religious thing. It's a cultural thing. It's a political thing. Here in the ancient world, they're all going together. And so when Perpetua says, no, I'm not going to sacrifice to the Roman gods or the emperor, she is showing the world a different way of life, which is not just about God being one or Jesus or whatever. It's about a way of life that receives its identity from the God who is love, not from a Roman Empire that is based on expanding the empire through violence, through expanding even the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, through the sword. You know, she is modeling a different way of life.
Well, and I'm struck, I can't believe I didn't mention this, in the background of the sacrifices to the gods, there's also this Roman patronage system whereby, the immediate theology would be there's a god for every space, every town, every corner, even every home. And when you give sacrifice to the god, when you pay a patronage to the god, you invite them to become your patron and to look after you and take care of you. And this isn't just a theological idea, it's also a practice. So, you know, the great patron would have been the emperor himself, who provides welfare and you know, aqueducts and takes care of the empire in payback for the loyalty of the citizens. And you would then see this extended where you know, the wealthiest person in town, which would be a location, because this was certainly not a, you know, it was closer to an oligarchy than a free market. So if you're the one guy in your town who's really, really wealthy, you need to find some way to redistribute some of that wealth. And so they would have thrown a lavish party and done lavish favors in return for, all the way down the pecking order, your loyalty to me. So you would only invite people to your party who could pay you back. And so when, first of all, the communion table is set by the Son of God, you have a reversal of that. And you have Perpetua, who, instead of giving sacrifice to the emperor, who is the highest of all patronages, she gives sacrifice to one who was arrested and hung on a cross. And so you have this radical reversal of power that's happening. And again, I think it the narrative historically begs out that her sacrifice is not just some nihilistic religious stunt that she should be a good mother. It's the most radical protest of the power system of her day. And she would have been incredibly offensive, because it wasn't, you didn't have a citizenry that was just, you know, walking around going, oh, this Roman patronage system, of which I'm at the bottom, is so oppressive. you would have had people bought in. You have the classic example, I want to say 100 years after, I mean, I guess we don't know exactly, but in the 4th century, you have Augustine writing the City of God to tell Romans, we don't need to worry about the gods of Rome. We have one city, the City of God, and if Rome burns because the patronage system broke down, then so be it. We have a treasure in Jesus that we have to hold on to, and you have perpetual paving the way for Augustine to write that theology later by living into it on our own, so to speak, and reversing those socially dominant structures that Jesus himself stirred her imagination to repicture and reimagine even unto death.
And how do we reimagine our lives today in a way that's similar to that, I guess? Because as you were saying, the people in Rome were like, this was offensive because, well, we're not seeing anything wrong with this. And they weren't callous people. But what we end up seeing is that we're often blind to our scapegoats, and we're blind to the ways in which we participate in systems that create marginalized people. And I think that blindness is something that, well, obviously is incredibly hard to see in our modern world today, too. So,
yeah. Well, and I'm struck the Girardian connections you're making. I think I shared this with you the other day, Adam, but I'm writing this paper on literally the doctrine of justification by faith and the saints, because that's going to be that's something I'll need to address if I'm going to talk to my own tribe of the Lutherans. And so the place that I thought I would start is this question, because many Protestants, I know Luther, Calvin, and Wesley have all said at one point that, now they're all partaking Luther's argument. I blame Luther for all of this.
Good.
The argument is that the scriptures don't provide the basis for venerating the saints. Now, that requires some definition, because part of what you have, so in the 11th, 12th, and 13th century, before the 11th century, the Pope is not involved with sainting at all. This is one thing I think liberal Protestants need to hear. The people saint first. So the first great saint, Saint Martin of Tours, gets sainted by his community because he loved them so well. And so even after he dies, they start telling the story of Saint Martin did this, Saint Martin did that. There's this incredibly heartwarming story. It almost makes your heart hurt. It's so sweet, where Martin shares his only coat with a beggar, and that night he has a dream where he gets to the gates of heaven and Jesus is wearing his coat. So I know. And some people would tell that story. That after he died, his community would preach that. And so I went in, the first step of this paper was wanting to address what I think is a myth, because frankly, the scriptures, so Moses does not come down with the 10th commandment, thou shalt venerate the saints. That much is true. But a couple things. By the 16th century, when the popes get involved with sainting, you end up inventing stories. You end up covering up sins, covering up struggles, and then you end up increasing the mythology around the saints. So you have these outlandish miracles, often many of them. And so, you know, Luther's real problem behind Luther always has this surface rhetoric where he speaks in the most dramatic terms ever, and often he's saying something very mundane in just like dramatic terms. So he goes on and on about the craziness of the saints, but what he's always saying is, if we make up stuff about the saints, they're not helpful anymore. I mean, that's his basic objection. And I think I told you this the other day. I was given a quote the other day, and I haven't located it in Luther's works. And Luther and Bonhoeffer and Abraham Lincoln are three people who get attributed, and Ben Franklin, four people who get attributed with saying everything that's ever been said in history. So whenever you get a quote on one of those gentlemen that you can't find, you got to be very suspicious.
Yeah.
But apparently Luther said, outside of the scriptures, the lives of the saints are the best thing a Christian can read if they are free of superstition and honest. So all of this is to say that when the first step in my paper is pointing out that it's kind of a myth that the scriptures, it's a poor hermeneutic to say the scriptures don't give us a calling to honor the lives of the saints. Like I said, Moses does not come down with the 11th commandment, thou shalt venerate the saints. However, they spend books and books and books telling us about Abraham and Isaac and Joseph and Sarah and Rebecca and Ruth and David and the judges. They tell us the stories of the first saints in order to do their theology. So that's the first problem. They do tell us mythologies of saints. And the Catholics have sainted people like Abraham and Jeremiah. I don't know if people realize that, but these are included in the canon. But so that was the first thing. And so as I was trying to construct this paper, I looked up where Paul in Corinthians says, imitate me as I imitate Christ, which is the perfect theology of the saints. That it isn't that we need to be more religious. It's here's an example that we can only judge after death of a friend of God. And the word that Paul uses when he says imitate me is mimetai in the Greek, which is the root word of mimetic theory, that to take my example as I follow the example of Christ. So I'm just struck biblically there's a deep, rich warrant that we need to rip the back pages off of our Bibles and know that this history of God's action and God's witnesses continue to spill forward into our history, as do things like the Crusades and so on and so forth, where there's grievous sins, where the church, by what it does and leaves left undone, fails its calling.
What is the church's calling?
I think the church's calling is to make space for the present Christ to form us and transform us. To receive again and again, as we come into Advent, this is very helpful language. The 4 weeks of Advent are simply about preparing ourselves to again. The Pietists were quite helpful on this. Their language of, the Pietists, the Moravians, Pietist Lutheran, Pietist Reforms would have talked about making space in your heart to be the manger for Jesus. And I think the call of the Christian church is to bear specific witness to Christ. Now, I don't believe that needs to ghettoize us as against other religions or making singular claims for truth. Jesus didn't really seem to do that, so I don't know that we as his followers need to. I do think that Christian theology that does not take the revealing gift of Christ as a gift from God to the world seriously will have a very hard time maintaining its sense of call. And so the notion of the church that can cosmically let go of Jesus for the sake of unity, that I think that is part of our call, and yet I think it's always a now but not yet kind of thing. We both need to take one step away from Christ into the larger global transcendent community, and yet a step toward Christ will most likely help us take that step away. It's one of those, we Lutherans like paradoxes, and it's a paradox, I guess. I can probably simplify that, make it more concrete, that I think it has something to do with the call to be Christ to each other. But I'm not one that thinks, I'm an interdisciplinary theologian, which sometimes Lutherans struggle with, which means that I don't think the word just does its work ex operate, as the phrase goes. I think that the spirit and the grace, God's grace is a part of it. I think somehow we need some theology to do some hermeneutics of how we read the Bible and to do some hermeneutics about how we interpret the phenomenology that points us to God's activity in the world. I also think we, to whatever degree we are or are not blank slates, the mind is an organ, a neurobiological organ. And so I think especially with Christian practices and affections, tending to how those things happen matters. And I think humans are social constructions. So it isn't just that the Bible gets to write on our blank slates. It's that the media and our parents and our grandparents and our teachers and our public school systems and our justice systems and our economic systems, all these things get to write on our slates. And so I tend to think that it's a cooperative effort between humans and God and disciplinary. I admit that I'm more interested, I have a sense of what the church is calling in is, but I'm more interested in how we fulfill that calling. What are we supposed to, maybe I'm buying into my own liberal modern myth. I want to produce something on behalf of the church.
Well, I think it matters what it is that
Luther
we are.
Does not like that theology.
Sorry. It certainly matters what it is that we're producing in the world. And if we're producing more violence and anger and hostility in the world, then we're going to get to this apocalyptic moment where we're going to destroy ourselves. And certainly Jesus gives us that warning. But if we're moving in more of a spirit of receiving the love that God has for all people, including those that we call our enemies, then maybe we'll produce a better, more loving, more gentle world through modeling our lives through Jesus and the saints and all of these gifts from God that you have been pointing us to throughout this talk. So
absolutely.
So thank you.
That's what I was trying to say.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for spending this time with us today. It's been a blessing.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. Okay. If anybody wants to read your paper, they can find it online at Religious Educators Association. And also I found out today by Googling For All the Saints, The Cult of Saints and Theological Imagination in the Art of Liberal Protestant Youth Ministry. I'll put it in the show notes as well, a link to the PDF there.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Talk to you later.